Okay, in theory, I'm recording this. Yeah, look at that. Okay, I think we're live. I will post the slides. So I went and read what you guys posted on the Canvas, and the winning topics are listed here. I'm going to go through these, take questions, and if there's time at the end, it's like roughly an hour. I'll open up for other questions. And I, in the case, have been pretty good about monitoring Piazza. And you should also answer each other's questions from the last year's exams. Here are bureaucracy. So the final exam, 2 hours. You haven't gotten the hour of 9 a.m. Know your pen ID number, your number two pencils over in DRL. You can also do it that way. Questions? We're good? We're good, okay. Autoencoders. So what autoencoders do we look at? What are the most popular, what's the most singular, widely used autoencoder? Trick question, maybe? PCA, right? Principal component is an autoencoder. It takes a high-dimensional X vector and compresses it down to K vectors to give you a new feature set. And it does it doing what? Oops, this is not useful. I'll just use this way. So what does PCA use in terms of autoencoding? It's trying to find ones which optimize what? What's the loss function? Reconstruction error, right? Wants to find an X hat that's as close as possible and an LP stands for visual X. And it does what constraints?
Orthogonality. Yay, right? So it minimizes distortion. In general, you subtract off the mean, unless it's sparse, you're trying to do things. You then write X equals Z times V transpose. And you can write it a bunch of different ways. Z's are called the, I always hate this nomenclature, but you gotta learn it. Scores, and V's are called the principal component loadings. Principal component scores, principal component loadings. And you minimize what we call equivalently distortion or reconstruction error. Exactly the same thing. Question. Good. ICA looks almost the same, independent component analysis. Well, you can also write that way. Where we have some X, we're going to find some S and W, where X is equal to S times W pseudo inverse. This looks just like PCA. Right? We've got a set of scores and a set of loadings. Except the scores now are called components. We want the scores or components to be independent of each other. And there's a million ICAs out there. But the one that I covered in class is one that's designed to look like PCA, which is the reconstruction ICA. And it minimizes a loss function which looks like exactly the same as PCA. It's the reconstruction error. So far, ICA and PCA are indistinguishable. Right? Take X, approximate it as a matrix times a matrix, minimize reconstruction error, except ICA does not require orthogonality. And instead it wants, among one of the interpretations, the scores to be as independent as possible. And the way we measure independence is typically using KL divergence. So what you'd like if you have a bunch of scores, each score is a column. If you have those probabilities, you like each of the columns to be independent, uncorrelated with each other, and KL divergence is a measure of how well the separated things approximate the full joint. That's all I care about ICA. I don't use it much, I use PCA, but it's popular in medical school.
Why?
Pardon?
Why?
I think tradition partly, and I think in machine learning we're mostly about predictive accuracy, and we mostly do PCA mostly to find new features to put as like PCR, or sometimes to plot things and have them in low dimensions and see them. In the medical school, people are mostly scientists actually, and they mostly want explanations. And this idea if there are two separate components driving things, or three different things that are driving it, then that independence maybe makes it more interpretable. So they're often concerned about interpretability ahead of predictive accuracy. The other piece is, which is faster to compute, PCA or ICA? PCA actually has very fast algorithms. How do we do PCA? How do we compute the principal components? SVD, and SVD is done using a power method to find the largest singular values. That scales beautifully. You can do that at Amazon scale and at Google scale. It's not hard to do multiplication, so power method. So you can run PCA really big, like at Google. ICA does not scale, so I've never seen anybody at Google or Amazon or Facebook use the ICA. And I don't know efficient algorithms do it like that. But the medical data is all tiny. Right? There's nothing there that's comparable to Amazon.
Cool. The other thing, which is very popular, yes, please.
For PCA, the SVD decomposition,
yep.
One of the quizzes mentioned that SVD determines
the null space of a matrix. Yes. Yeah, so null space, we haven't really covered much in this course, but in linear algebra, multiply a matrix by a right singular vector, or an eigenvector if it's a square vector matrix. If you get an eigenvalue of 0, those eigenvectors that give eigenvalues of 0 are the null space. That will not be on the exam. That's a more of a prerequisite than a
thing covered. Cool. The other piece, which is popular now, and I did in the lecture, we talked about reconstruction ICA in a deep learning setting. And the idea, we've seen a bunch of these autoencoders in some form or another, is that you take some sort of an input, an X, an image, or a sentence. You're then going to run it through a neural net. We'll do in a second how to do this to get some sort of encoding, which will be a k-dimensional encoding. And then we'll take those k dimensions and invert it, kind of an opposite, and of course it goes back and reconstructs it. And there are a bunch of ways to do this, but the most popular one is take the original image and then take 10% of the pixels and just gray them out. Or take the original sentence and take two of the words and delete them and put it into it. So you take noise, 1 second. So you delete some piece of the image or the noise as your input, and then you try and take some output that then is going to reconstruct it. And the nice thing is, this is as if it were supervised, because you have the input and the output, but it's entirely unsupervised because there's no labels. Question?
Yeah, so is the point of difference to increase computational speed, or is it so that it
wasn't? So why do I care? Excellent question. Why do I care about taking some image and encoding it in some k-dimensional embedding? Yeah?
You can find certain characteristics about the image.
Well, you find, in some sense, images that are similar in semantic space, or word sentences that are similar in meaning, should be close in the embedded space, even though they're far away in the pixel space, or the word space, or the character space. So a given sequence of English characters may be very different, but really mean the same thing. And you hope that if you do this right, the embedding captures that. These are often used in what kind of learning? Semi-supervised, right? So almost all of where people use embeddings for autoencoders is mostly for take some original feature space, put it in some new feature space, such that you can then train some data set. The nice thing about semi-supervised, why bother doing semi-supervised learning? Why not just do deep learning on the original image and the label? There's not enough labeled data. Labeled data is often expensive. Unlabeled data is usually available in almost unlimited quantity, certainly in the Facebook, Google world. There's infinite unlabeled data. How many images do you want? A billion? No problem. Here they are, right? How many images, take a billion labels and label all the stuff in them? That's expensive, even for Facebook.
So these are super useful ways. And what you see when you look at these, see if my pointer works. Is that? Yeah, look at that. What you see is you take your input, you do it through some labels, and if you look at the feature images that most excite labels, say images that are close to the input, they tend to be feature detectors, things like edges or colors or low-level features. And if you look at the ones deeper in, they tend to be excited by images like faces or cats. And what this means is with a crap load of unlabeled data, you can learn embedding, which with only a couple examples of cats and people are really good at recognizing. Yeah?
Why do you have to add noise to the input before you put it in one?
Why add noise? Well, if I have a really good neural net, I take something that's a 500 dimensional input, and I run it through a 500 dimensional in layer, and I have a 500 dimensional output, what's it going to learn? The identity mapping. Yes, so now the question has got to be something, and let's talk about the bottleneck. In the old-fashioned days, like 10 years ago, people used to make literally a bottleneck. You have a 500-dimensional input, and then a 50-dimensional bottleneck, like a principal component. You have fewer principal components, K, than input P, right? So the old-fashioned bottleneck were literally a bottleneck, got smaller like a bottle does, and therefore you couldn't reconstruct it all. But it still turned out that we were too well. The modern style that seems to work better is to do two things. One is to add noise in, which means you don't have to have a literal bottleneck. You can have as many or more. K can be bigger than P. It's very common now to embed images in bigger spaces than the original image itself. Right? Now you've got to do something to prevent this identity from happening. But the most common way is to add noise in. The other way you can do it, how else do you prevent overfitting? Regularization, right? L2, L1, various sorts of things that force it so it can't do it perfectly. Why is it better? That's a long, complicated story, but it seems for most things like images and language, which are these ones to use, better to put some noise in and then reconstruct it using a high-dimensional input, which then captures all sorts of features about it with some L1, L2 regularization. That seems to capture a large set of features that is better in the future to sort of recognize some new object you've never seen on meerkat before, and this is your first meerkat, but you want to have some embedding that's good at finding meerkats. Make sense? So the bottleneck would work, but it seems not to do as good a job of capturing a nice embedding that generalizes well to new images and new sentences. Yeah?
Sorry, I have a question from earlier.
Yeah.
We said before that PCA is linear. Make it
nonlinear by doing parallel PCA? So PCA is linear. Pretty much everything we've covered in this course, almost everything at some point has dot product of x's with x's, or matrix multiplies, and everywhere you have a dot product of two x's, that's a linear kernel. You can replace that dot product with something else, like a Gaussian kernel. So yes, you can kernelize pretty much, if you look through this course, everything I can think of is basically vector multiplication. And every time you multiply an x with an x, that's a linear kernel. You can replace it with a Gaussian kernel. There's only one place where that's pretty much all or widely done, the most wide use of kernels. SVMs are pretty much always kernelized. Why do people not kernelize deep learning? You don't need to. It's learning the nonlinear features. You do the kernelization because you're in a linear world, like a linear SVM or a linear regression, and you want to make it nonlinear to kernelize it. You do a kernelized regression or a kernelized SVM. Yeah.
So ICA then is nonlinear, but
well, ICA, does ICA learn a linear model or a nonlinear model? It's a linear model. So let's be precise about linear and nonlinear. ICA learns the exact same equational form that PCA learns. They both take a vector and multiply it into two things that multiply by each other. They're exactly the same in terms of what they learn, but they learn different numbers in them because it's a different loss function. Right? But yeah, it's also a linear model. But you can do a nonlinear PCA, which looks like an autoencoder, or you can do a nonlinear ICA, which looks like an autoencoder. And in fact, the example I showed from Google and Quapalo was in fact a nonlinear reconstruction ICA. Right? Instead of having a linear function, it just pulls in a neural net.
Cool.
Yes. And so the slightly odd piece is PCA always reduces dimensionality. You can never have more physical components than the original ones. ICA in the old-fashioned world often keeps equal numbers, but you don't have to. And often in modern encoding, you encode to a bigger dimension than the original one. There's no reason to shrink it. Cool. The way that these things often work is via stacking, which is sort of cool recursive structure. You learn one encoder that takes an input image, maps it to a deep learner, just one layer to a hidden layer, anti-maps it back to a second layer to the original input. So it has a noisy input, hidden layer, output, which is what input should have been, train the neural net. So far, so good. It's nice. It's an easy neural net. It's got one hidden layer. Now what we do is we throw away the last the decoder part. We keep the encoder. The encoder is the first layer. The output of the hidden layers are the encoding or the embedding. I use those pretty much interchangeably, right? An embedding just puts things in some vector representation. Encoding takes some original thing and transforms it. It embeds it, right? Same thing. So we now have the embedding, which is the output of the hidden layers. So far, so good. Now we take those and feed those into another neural net that takes the embedded features, gives them to a hidden layer, outputs noise to them, gives them a hidden layer, outputs the bridge to them, and learns a second layer. So this is great for training. In fact, you train one layer at a time. Yeah. Right, freeze the previous layer. Yes, I froze the previous layers. So at this point, all I have is I use the original first layer frozen, and then takes the output. That output is now my new input. These features are, there's no training back there. I just freeze each layer one at a time. What you're going to do is each layer will then do one more deeper embedding, and then there'll be an decoding at the back, which will have each of the decoders set. You go from original to features to deep features, and then decode back to feature estimates and back to original estimates. And in the end, we're going to throw away all the things except the encoding part. We've got a mapping that takes the image and then encodes it into something which is a deep representation. And the deep representations do seem to come closer to capture meaning. At least they generalize better. They're good features to use. Things that are close to those tend to have similar labels, similar meanings. Super powerful method.
Okay, stacking. Yep, and then use those embeddings for features. Okay, the next topic. We're just zipping through here. Belief nets.
We've looked at a whole bunch of things that go by the name of belief nets or Bayesian belief nets. Or Bayesian nets, all of which I will use interchangeably, have used naive Bayes, Gaussian mixture models, LDA, hidden Markov models. Perhaps the quintessential belief net looks like a picture of a bunch of nodes and a bunch of lines. What meaning or semantics does this capture? In two words, what's a belief net showing you? Conditional independence, right? This is a picture drawing conditional independence. And on a typical exam question, you will have something that looks like, in English, is B conditionally independent of C given A? Right? So I'll use the little plusy thing there. That's the conditional independent part. So here's a typical exam question. I guarantee there'll be one on the exam. Oh, I have inside information. So is B conditionally independent of C given A? I get mostly yeses, or I think a couple no's. Yeah? It is yes. It is conditionally independent. You've got the parent. Who's the parent here? A. By the way, what property does this graph have to have in graph nomenclature terms? It's acyclic. It's a directed acyclic graph, right? All belief nets are directed acyclic graphs. There are other kinds of graphs that are not directed acyclic, but we didn't cover them. They're not belief nets. Yeah?
So the first answer is yes, because E is blocking. A blocks.
The connection from B to C, A D separates A from C. These are equivalent ones. There is no active trail from A to C, from B to C. Once you know A, learning B tells you nothing more about C. And you can start by writing. If I had, do I have a board? Wow.
I could be old fashioned, right, chalk. If you were, if you had, for example, a blackboard.
Sorry, close the phone. What sort of probabilities do I need to write down to capture this thing? Well, the first thing I have to have is the probability of A. Do I need the probability of not A? 1 minus that, okay. Then for B, what do I get? I get the probability of B given A. What else do I need? Probability of B given not A. That's the two probabilities associated with B. Note that once I know A, I know B. And then on the other side, simply for C, probability of C given A, probability of C given not A. Yeah.
There are like four rules in
slides. Yeah. The rules are pretty much exhaustive. All you get really is this thing represents a probability, right? This whole probability trip will write out the good thing again, probability of A times the probability of B given A times the probability of C given A times the probability of E given what? B and D. When I write that, how many numbers is that representing? 4, right? Probability of E given B and D, B given B and not B, E given not B and D, E given not B and not B, right? That's 4 different numbers here. Times probability of D given what? C, I guess, is all. And we're writing for, oh no, and F. Yes, that one, not okay. C and F. And what else do I need? Probably F. That is the whole equation. That is the distribution that represents. That's just a pretty picture. That means this equation. Yeah.
And then when there's a question that says like there are 10 nodes, how many parameters are needed to?
How many parameters are in this model sample? This is 1, this is 2, this is 2, this is 4, this is 4, this is 1, I don't know if that's the answer. Now, the one tricky piece, I've assumed these things are binary. They could take on 3 values. If A can take on red, green, or blue, how many numbers is this? 2, right? So you need to be a little careful about counting the combinations, but that's how this is the model. That's how many parameters it is.
That's upper bound by 2 to the n minus 1.
And two, if you had no information, you would have 2 to the n of a binary to 2 to the n minus 1. And this is less than or equal to, in this case, guaranteed less than 2 to the n minus 1. Right? And the important thing is 2 to the n minus 1 goes up exponentially in the number of nodes. This sort of thing is going to be sort of more like linear in the number of nodes, because these are going to be small numbers here. So it gives you a way more compact representation. Cool. Okay, so B is conditionally independent of C given A. How about B and D given E? Yes, no? No, right? That's the weird one. That's the rule that messes people up. If you know E, learning B tells you something about D. We actually have a funny English term for this, explaining away. If B or D can cause E, if I learn that B was there and caused E, then it's less likely that B was there. Whereas if B didn't happen, and one of the two has to happen to make it happen, then D will happen. Or you can just memorize it. But B is not conditionally independent of D given E. Yep.
Can you explain that it's a little different, but when you're constructing the belief net, yep, you add in a new node, what are the probabilities that you check to see if there's a line?
So, yes, I'm not going to go through the process, and it's too long to reconstruct on the piece there, but I think the important thing to do is, what are the semantics? What's the meaning of the network? And when would there be a line from A to D. I didn't draw a line from A to D. What's the lack of line from A to D mean, right? In some sense, the line that's not there is telling you something. Yeah?
Probability of D
equals probability of D given A. Is that correct? No, it's not quite correct, I'm afraid. Nice try, but we write in spirit, but not quite wrong, right? So, at the moment, what do we have? We have the probability of B given C and F. And, right, B has arrows from C to F. The lack of a line from A is saying that, if I know C and F, what does A tell me about B? Nothing. Right? In fact, if I know C, learning A tells me nothing about it. You with me? So this is not quite true. Yep?
If you know C, though, is it there still an accurate trail from A to B to E to D?
If I know C, is there a trail from
A to B to E to D?
Yeah. If I learn A, tells me about B, which tells me about E, be careful. I don't know E. Think if I know E, then I'm going to get an active trail back up through there. If I don't know E, I think I've got no active trail. Right?
Yeah.
I think there is, under this model, there's no information flow. So I think what I want to say is that what I had was the probability of B given C, and if I were to learn A on top of that, the probability of D given C and A is the same, right? Learning A once I know C tells me nothing more about D, right? Whether C is true or false, whether A is true or false, doesn't matter. Once I know C, learning A tells me nothing more, right? So the lack of a line, in some sense, is the conditional independence. Yes?
So does the conditional independence already hold it by only observing like one of the parents in this case? Like,
in this particular case, yes. So you can see that because F is sort of off by itself, A doesn't point to F. So in this case, I could also put in F here, and F here, that's also true. So it's sort of vacuously true. So if it makes you happier to put an F there, go for it. Still true. That sort of ignores, so this particular case is a special tree. There could have been a line from A to F, in which case I would need to have the F there. Remember, so the important thing to do is to translate this picture into this equation, which lets you know how many parameters it is, which I care about mostly because it's linear rather than exponential number of nodes, and exponential is intractable in my world. I like linear. And I guess the other piece is that it allows me to, given any set of numbers, I can estimate something else. So I give it a full distribution. And then the notice that these all sort of move forward. They give the probability of the children given the parents. If I were to give you a question about the parents' probability given the children, how do I find it? If I ask you the probability of F given B, Bayes' rule, right? So Bayes' rule is when you turn it around. And that's all there really is. All there is conditional dependence in Bayes' rule. In the good old days before neural nets, I would have told you a whole bunch of efficient algorithms for solving it and doing the search, but nobody gives a crap anymore. There are lots of message passing, gradient descent algorithms, but I don't care. But the representation is still useful. Good? Now we can look at a bunch of special cases. One super special case is the naive Bayes classifier. It's a belief net, and we will now use the nice nomenclature. The shaded nodes are observed.
the clear nodes that are not shaded or not observed. Everything's observed here. By the way, how many parameters? If there are two classes and five possible features here, I need what? The probability of C, one parameter. And I need the probability of X1 given C. And how many parameters? Is it 5 plus 1? Sorry?
There's 5 data, 2 for each.
I need 2 for each conditional probability, right? I need the probability of feature X1 given the class being A, and I need the probability of X1 being the feature given the class being not A. Make sense? So there are 11 parameters in this model. Make sense? Yes. Cool. And so, yes?
Yes. Hypothetically, if they just become three values, the x's, would the coefficient be like 3 times the number?
Excellent question. So say x, say each of the x's took on 3 values. We're going to learn how many parameters. Let's just look at the property of x1. So if I write the probability of x1 given c, and assume x has 3 values and c has 2 values, what am I really writing here? Let's do a table. X1, c, I need x1. I've got red, c is class A. I've got green, c is class A. Do I need blue given class A? Nope. I need red given class not A. I need green given class not A. I got it. Okay, so I've got 4 parameters if X1 takes on 3 values and C takes on 2. Good? Let's swap it. Let's do 2 X1s and 3 C's. Now, I've got the probability of X1 being true, given class is red. Do I need the probability of X1 being false, given that X is red? Nope. I need the probability of X1 is true, given class is green. I need it true, given that it's blue. Oh, I'm done, I guess. Different number. Oh, wait, am I done? I got all 3 classes. Red, green, and blue. I've got X1 being true. X1 being false is 1 minus. I'm done. Make sense? I never tried to memorize these things. They work them out. Good. Okay. So, if you want to actually learn the model, estimate the model, you need to estimate the probability of the classes, which has a funny name called the base rate. How likely that is, like a base rate for the disease. You're trying to estimate probability of having flu, what percentage of people have flu. Right? So you have the base rate of each class, how likely it is if you know nothing about the x's. And then you need to know the probability of each feature given each class. And MLE just is counted up. We also showed how to add in a pseudo count, like 1, which had funny names you could forget, like will pause. So they, you should know if you do an MLE version. And language is really weird. If you look at naive Bayes for words, what you typically do is, in theory, you should have the probability of X1 being true and of X1 being false. If you're diagnosing diseases, if I have a probability of you're having a high temperature given a disease, I also want to have the probability of you're not having a high temperature given a disease. Right? So in medicine, not seeing something is significant, right? A feature being false is just as informative as it is being true in the general diagnostic case, right? That's why we need to be able to compute the probability of X1 being false for a given class, right? Because some diseases, you always pretty much like probably other people. If you don't have it, it's going to rule out the disease. On the other hand, for language, the probability of most words showing up in most documents
It's effectively zero. Or put conversely, the probability of not seeing a given word avocado in a given tweet is pretty much one. So in general, for language in these 9 Bays, you only take the probabilities over the words that are there, and you ignore all the probabilities of the words that are not there on the theory that all those probabilities should be one, basically.
There's also something slightly odd. When I write the probability of class given X, I said it's proportional to probability of C given probability of X given C. I dropped out something.
The probability of X, right? This is almost Bayes' rule. 9 Bayes does not give accurate probability estimates. It's used almost always as a classifier. Find the R max, the most likely label. So I don't care about the X, which I can't estimate well anyway, because the X's are not independent.
Good. Good? Okay. We didn't say much about it, but I mentioned it in passing.
You can do the same thing instead of having X's, the features, be binary. You can have them be real. So you would have for each class the exact same sort of equation. Probably class given X and probably class and probably X given class. But I can write the probably X given class as coming from a Gaussian to get real valued X's. And if I want the X's to be conditionally independent, then the covariance matrix between the features needs to be diagonal. Right? What's a diagonal covariance means? The covariance between any feature on the other feature? Zero. That's what we mean by independent. Or in this case, conditionally independent on the class. So I guess it's probably won't be in the final, actually. But just to remind you, it's the same structure that 9 Bayes could be a Gaussian 9 Bayes instead of a binary one.
Cool, so far, so good. But now I can go to one other thing that may well be on the final. I won't tell you. I don't remember.
Which looks like a Gaussian 9 Bayes, but is a Gaussian mixture model. I changed one key thing. I don't know the classes anymore. The classes are non-observable, and I'm no longer naive, so I'm just going to assume that every X feature, I'm going to draw a sample from one class, one of k classes, and then I'll pick a point x from some Gaussian. And I won't talk about today, but in the notes, the covariance matrix could be diagonal, could be full, could be all the same along the diagonal, could be different each cluster, could be quite different versions. Cool. How do we estimate this? So far, I'm getting the EM, right? And EM, so far, so good. EM always will come back in. Well, we'll come back into this in a second.
No, let's do it right now, actually.
So EM always has 2 steps. What's the E step here? Expectation, I know, but what is it? What are we finding the expectation of? Yep. Of the latent variables. What are the latent variables here? The hidden variables are called EM. What are the hidden variables? The class membership, right? For each of my points, my n points here, we want to know how much it belongs to each class. Yep.
What is C here? Is C?
C is the class label.
Is it a set of classes or is it one class?
It's a set of classes. So C is a random variable which takes on one of k different labels, right? So general guessing is from k classes, k components in my picture, k classes. So C takes on a label from 1 to K, which of the K ones it is. What I'd like to know is for each of the endpoints, I want to know the probability of the class, by relation A, the class is equal to any of those K values, given X is equal to one of the X's. We're going to call X of I. Right? So given some X, I'd like to know its distribution across the k-class. This is the probability distribution, right? The k numbers, k probabilities, it's on the 1. And the e-step estimates how much each point belongs in each class. Yeah?
The arrows go the other way in the tree,
though. Sorry?
The arrows go the other way in the tree, so it's c positive x1. But in the conditional probability, you have
Oh yes, annoyingly, I have written here that this is the definition of class membership. And unfortunately, as you point out, the class membership is the other direction from the arrow. How do I solve this problem? Oh, the probability of the parent given the child? I need to use Bayes' rule. So the way to compute the expected value, the expectation from the ECF, is almost always to use Bayes' rule. Right? So you, I'm going to need to use Bayes' rule to do this. Make sense? Well, what do I have? This is equal to or proportional to probability of X given C. What else do I have in probability of Bayes' rule? Probability of C over some normalization constant, which looks like probability of X. Okay, so what's probability of C? The class membership, right? How many things on expectation are in each class. I need to know that to do this. And probably X given C is going to look like a, what sort of distribution in this example? The Gaussian, right? So in particular, it's going to be normal with some mean, which depends upon the class K, and some covariance, which might also depend upon the class K. Right, so for a given class, right, the probability of X having some value given the class is the K, class number K, that will come from a distribution with mean use of K and variance sigmas of K. Make sense? So I need to know those to compute this. It's a back and forth algorithm, right? Let's put that on hold for a second. Let's look at the M step. Then we'll come back to this one. What does the M step estimate? The parameters. What are the parameters of the Gaussian mixture model? I need to know mu and sigma for each of my K classes. Any more parameters? I also need to know the probability of each of the classes, which I sometimes call pi. Right? So the parameters in this model are the base rates of each class, right? K numbers, between 0 and 1 and sum to 1, and the means and the covariance matrices of each of the classes. And often we'll assume the covariance matrices are diagonal or something, but that's still it. So how, and this is the M step, which is M for maximization. What am I maximizing? The likelihood, right? MLA usually or MAP. And let's just try and create something like mu. If I were, say, to estimate mu, the centroid of K, what is my maximum likelihood estimate of the centroid of a cluster under this world? We estimate averages, right? The centroid's the average. I want to take the summation. I go from 1 to n, my n points. Each of those points, x of I, times what? The class membership. There it is. The class membership. So cheating, equal, oh, and I better do something that makes it an average. I need to divide by the summation of the class membership. But basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to average, I'm going to take every point, and it's going to contribute to the maximum likelihood estimate. If this were a hard clustering, what's the hard clustering version of Gaussian mixture model that you look at? K-means. If it's a hard clustering, these memberships are 0 or 1. That's what hard means. Class probability is either 1 or 0. You just sum over those and divide by the number of points in the cluster. Right, for k-means. But for the soft clustering, which the Gaussian mixture model is, we're going to take for every point, how much does it belong in this cluster? We'll weight the points by that. Then we'll divide by the summation of the total memberships, which is an estimate of the number of points in that cluster. That's the EM algorithm. It it finds the expected class memberships, and then it finds the maximum likelihood estimates of the parameters, and the same thing for the covariance matrix, but it's just a weighting of the covariance matrix. Don't write it out. And you go back and forth. In order to find the parameter MLE, you need to know the class memberships. And in order to find the class memberships, you need to know the parameter estimates. So you got to start somewhere. But that's it. Yeah?
I remember we said that sometimes it gets analytically difficult. Is that in the maximizing the likelihood?
For this particular Gaussian mixture model, the whole thing is closed. Each E step and the M step are closed form. For other sorts of problems like Leighton-Hirsch layout location, which is a fancier generalization we'll cover in a second, now one of these two steps becomes non-closed form, and you gotta do some approximation, which have funny names, which we're not gonna cover, like variational methods. And the answer is, yeah, you could, in theory, either of these two steps can become intractable, and then you do some approximation. But the key point about this is each of these steps is guaranteed to move you toward increased likelihood. This is a gradient descent, or an alternating gradient descent in likelihood. It is guaranteed to converge to an optimum likelihood. That's the good news. The bad news? The fine print? It's never a global optimum, well, occasionally. It's rarely a global optimum. There's no guarantee, right? In general, we say we don't give you global optimum.
Good. So that's EM. Oh yes, we used it for two things. We used it for Gaussian mixture models, and I'll leave you from doing a second.
The other place we used EM for was, what's the fancy word for it? Out there, missing data? Imputation. Technical term you should know. That should just call it. What's the missing data in imputation usually? Just missing data, right? Not cluster membership, but you actually have some X matrix and some of the numbers aren't there. So the E step is going to estimate the missing data, give you values for the missing data. The M step will estimate something about your model, the average of every feature, or the regression weights in the model, or something like that. You go back and forth. So very much the same idea. The key assumption behind imputation, when can I or can I not use imputation safely? Are the data missing at random? They're missing at random, imputation works awesomely well. If they're not missing at random, what do machine learning people do? Make a new column, missing or not missing, a new variable, get twice as many features, but that's okay. You can do feature selection. Twice as many features is not scary. That's always the safest thing to do.
Cool. That's pretty much it. We did E step, we did M step. Good on EM? Oh yeah, we gotta keep moving. Time is short. LDA model.
So LDA model is a generalization of the naive Bayes model. We have a set of documents. I've shown here three different documents. For every document, I've shown three words, but you can't see the words, they're the observables in orange. And we're gonna have a model of the following. For each document, we're going to choose a distribution over topics data, which says what percentage of the words do I expect to come from each of my k different topics. Then for each word, I will choose a topic, one of the k topics from the distribution of data. Then from that topic, I will choose a word with a probability of data, probably word given topic, which looks a lot like a naive Bayes model. And I will predict. That's the generative model. We're going to solve this with EM. What's hidden here? What are the, yeah?
Everything other than the words.
Everything other words, basically, yeah. Although often people take, sometimes they think alpha is hidden, sometimes it's a hyperparameter. So often, in fact, alpha is a weird name, concentration parameter. So alpha might not be hidden, but for sure the z's and the thetas are hidden. Are the betas hidden? He said everything except the words. Hidden in the sense, remember that the EM step has two things. In E, you estimate the missing or hidden data, and the M, you estimate the parameters. So like something here better be a parameter, and something here better be missing. You with me? For my EM to work? So you said everything, so somehow you go through with no parameters. So I can't be right. What are the parameters in this model? Beta. The probability of the words given each of the k
topics are the parameters. Beta are parameters in this block. They are going to be estimated in the M step. The E step is going to find the thetas, which are the hidden distributions, and the Z's, the topic numbers. And it's a little bit messier, you don't need to know how it works, I didn't really cover it. But you do need to know that this is a generalization that has parameters instead of a naive, well, it looks like a naive Bayes model with the betas. For each topic, here's how likely every word is, given the topic. Those are the parameters in the model. Now, the other piece that's weird is every document now is a distribution over topics. So the thetas are hidden, and the topic membership of each word is zero. Right, so parameters, beta, hyperparameter, alpha, arguably concentration. Yeah?
Because this is EM, does it also converge to the local optimum?
Yes, because this EM is the local optimum, and one of the annoying things, since I do a lot of stuff for a living, there's a whole bunch of packages out there, and some of them converge to good optima, and some of them converge to crappy optima. So without knowing a lot of machine learning, if you use an LD algorithm, some of them will converge nicely, and some of them converge just crap.
Why does implementation matter?
Why does it matter? Because many of them use a different method you can call called Gibbs sampling, or different variational approximations. You can't do a closed form of the two steps of EM, so there's a bunch of approximations that come in. There's a whole course, a change engine based on how to take teaches and then work on how to do these sort of search methods. But the answer is something this non-linear, the search method really does sort of matter. But that's out of scope for this course. Except the important point, which is it does not convert to a global optimum, but it really matters how you do the search. Yeah.
So if I have a corpus of documents,
yeah,
which already have text in them,
yeah,
I'm confused on why we're generating words.
Okay, so the model is how the words would have been generated. You're given the words. So why do I use LDA? I got a bunch of documents with words. What is this giving me for those documents? Why do I build the app?
Oh, it's a topic.
It gives me for every document a distribution of the topics it's in, which is super useful. And it also is a clustering algorithm. What are the clusters hidden in LDA? The betas are the probability of each word given each topic. Each topic is a cluster of words. It's a weird cluster, hard or soft? It's a soft cluster. Every topic can show up in every word, but it's still a clustering algorithm, right? It's very far from the Gaussian mixture model, but in some level it's the same idea. Every component in the Gaussian mixture model has some Gaussian distribution of real value x's. In this case, every topic in the LDA model has some distribution over the words. So this is a soft clustering method. It gives you soft clusters of words, and that means that you can do this as an unsupervised method. This is unsupervised on the labels. You then run this on a big collection of documents, no shortage of documents. I got 40 billion tweets. That's a lot of documents. I run this over 40 billion. Well, I can't even afford that. But I order some small fraction over a quarter billion tweets. I get out my topics. I can now take any document and map it to say a distribution over 1,000 topics. So it's a nice way to actually generate features. This is, again, a semi-supervised learning. Unsupervised, learn the clusters of words, then you can map any set of words to some sort of embedding, which is the distribution over topics of that document. Yeah? So the M step, we're learning beta and alpha, or often, depending on which software, often you specify alpha as a hyperparameter and don't learn it. But yes, you learn beta and sometimes alpha in the M step.
So then what makes like alpha different from beta that you can tune in?
Ah, what's the dimension of beta? Vocabulary by number of topics. What's the dimension of alpha? A scalar. Hyperparameter is fine to have one knob to tune. Alpha controls roughly, you want like two or three topics in every document, or you want 20 or 30, or 200 or 300 topics. So alpha is the concentration. It's a single number. You don't feel too bad specifying one number as a hyperparameter that says, I want to have two or three topics per document, an expectation. Whereas there's no way you could have a hyperparameter vocabulary by topic. That's the whole thing you're trying to find is the beta. So beta would be impossible as a hyperparameter. Alpha is one number. You can estimate it and set it. Cool.
And we'll move on. Cool. The next and final class of Bayesian belief nets, hidden Markov models.
Hidden Markov models are dynamic belief nets, are dynamic Bayesian belief net, dynamic in the sense that you have time, got a single length of your time. We have a sequence of states, which are you're in one of k states. You have a Markov transition matrix, you could probably go to the next state, and in the version we look at most, a probably an emission B. Cool. So the parameters in the Markov model, M and B, transition matrix, emission one. Super easy to compute here, right? Because you know the states, you know that you just estimate the probabilities by counting MLA or MAP. We also do one really important generalization called a Markov decision process, where we say it looks like this, but we're going to take an action, one of k actions. And for each action we pick on the k actions, there'll be a potentially different Markov condition. Shouldn't use k, there's two different k. That should have some different each action a, right? K states, transition to k states, a possible actors. Good. Yes?
Is there no hidden variable?
Where is the hidden variable on this slide? There is no hidden variables here. Everything here is fully observable so far. So the Markov model is fully observable. A Markov decision process is fully observable. Everything here is observable. Beta is not hidden. Beta is a parameter. B or M are parameters. There's nothing hidden here. There's no EM algorithm. So far, so good? Now let's hide something. What we hide are the states. Once you hide them, it's called a hidden Markov model, which makes a lot of sense, which we covered. If you hide them in the Markov decision process, we didn't cover it, but it's called a partially observable Markov decision process, or a POMDP. I love it. Sometimes they POMDP. That's like a pomegranate or something. Okay, so now in the hidden Markov model, again, what's hidden? The states at each time, so I'm going to solve this how? EM algorithm, back and forth. I'm going to take the E step, I'm going to estimate what? What did the state of probability at each time? And the M step, the parameters M and D. Cool. The only weird thing about this diagram, Westerly, whoa, don't go to sleep.
Who's gone to sleep? No. Hello? Wake up. Oh, okay, it's been an hour, but okay,
we'll hang in. Where was I? Oh, right. The weird thing about this matrix, what's the relationship between each of the different M's on this picture? The Markovian, yeah, that means that once you have a that each M, each state de-separates the past from the future. So this is a Bayesian belief net in the precise sense of Markovian. But what's the relationship between that first M, the second M, and the third M? They're all exactly the same, right? You've unrolled the network. All those Bs are the same. There's only one M matrix and one B matrix. I've drawn it the way it works, which is if I want to go from something where I know state one to state 4, I'm going to multiply it by m and by m and by m again to get to state 4. I'll have to use Bayesian for some things. But it's the same m at every point. It's the same, those parameters are the same. They're reused, they're shared, they're tied. Make sense? So it just means that the gradient descent sorts of things are a little bit messier or whatever, but same piece there.
Cool. We had hidden parameters, estimated. Cool. We did that. Last piece, reinforcement learning. Okay, so what are the key dimensions that reinforcement learning algorithms differ on?
On policy, off policy, and model-based and model-free.
The
Model-based ones are you write down a Markov decision process. That same thing I just said. There's a transition matrix, which is a function action, and there's a probability of emitting something you can observe and some reward. So that's a model-based model. The other thing we do is either learn stuff on policy. We have a policy. Policy is what? The mapping from state to action. Why would I want to learn off policy? Why would I, again, I'm trying to find the policy, I'm going to do something. Why would I learn other than on policy? Yeah? I need to explore is the biggest reason. If I'm always on policy, I'm stuck doing the same back explore. The other reason people go off policy are sometimes there's safety concerns. In the real world, they don't want to actually try certain things, you prohibit them. And sometimes in gameplay, in older versions like AlphaGo, you would have one current policy and you play against an older version of yourself or something. So you might actually have something or a faster version of the network. So sometimes you'd approximate your model with a different one. Yep.
If we do an epsilon greedy strategy, would that every time you take the epsilon step be off policy?
So if you do epsilon greedy, what does an epsilon greedy on policy look like? Or epsilon greedy off policy? Let's do epsilon greedy on policy. What does that mean? You take a first initial step following epsilon greedy, and then in the future you are epsilon greedy. That's on policy, right? The other thing you could do is take a first step, which is epsilon greedy, and then in the future always be greedy. Yeah?
If you're epsilon greedy at every step, is that basically what SARSA is?
Yes! Yes, so we have that. So SARSA is on policy. You're epsilon greedy forever, right? Which is sort of cool because you're on policy, but it sort of means you're always exploring. You never converge, right? So in fact, most people don't use SARSA, which is epsilon greedy on policy. Pretty much all the modern systems today, at least in this year, a few years, use a Q-learning method, which is an epsilon greedy initial choice, and then follow something that's some approximation to greedy or on policy to try and learn off of. Make sense? So in fact, people don't want to be on policy because you want to explore your first step, and then you want to be on you want to be optimal or maybe a cheaper, faster, older version of on policy. You want to be greedy afterwards. Make sense? So SARSA on policy, and I have this also in the slides. Cool. The other big question is, are you going to do one step, take one action, make your new estimate update, or are you going to take one action and then estimate the next thing by playing a whole bunch of times to get to win or lose? A whole bunch of times, 100 by 100 game playing is called Monte Carlo, because you can't afford to do a full tree search, that's way too expensive. So you can either do Monte Carlo play, estimate the next one, or you can just do one step. The one step ahead one is called T0, temporal difference. Zero, it's like Python-based indexing. Zero means one step. It's the shortest you could do. Sorry, but you know, you're Pythonic, it won't bother you too much. And as we said, SARSA is epsilon greedy on policy, and the more commonly used ones are Q-learning, which are some variation of epsilon greedy or some other sort of exploring. I covered a bunch of details you can all forget about how AlphaZero today does other clever ways of being a little bit greedy. But you do need to know this Q-learning. One greedy thing, then go optimal, yeah?
Is there
anything we're changing in Monte Carlo, the starting state, or the starting state? In Monte, the TD0 and Monte Carlo are really different. In TD0, I take one step, I then look what reward I got, I look at the Q function at that next step, and say, hey, that's my step table. I'll show you the equation in a second. I'm just looking one step ahead. In Monte Carlo, I take one action, I go there, and instead of looking at the Q value there, I play the game out 100 times and see who wins and loads. Yeah, I lost 70%. This is a 0.3 good state. So, I mean, I'm always in some state, I take some action, say I play greedy, I go somewhere, how good is this? Either I'm TD0, just look up the Q function, or I'm Monte Carlo, run a whole bunch of games to the end, which costs me a bunch of Q time, and then see how well I did with my estimate. Make sense? So it's a different way of saying how good is the next step. Yep?
TD0 would be considered
TD0 is always model 3, yes.
So in one of the quizzes,
yeah.
TD0 is a type keyword and therefore model 3.
Oh, that's a stupidly tricky one. TD0 can also be used in a purely value functions. We gave an example in class. You can do TD0 for values as well as value learning as well as key learning. That's rather too picky a question, but yeah. But yes, TD0 is often used for value learning, for V learning, as well as for Q learning. Yep.
So there's like at least two kinds of Q learning, right? There's Epsilon V,
yep.
And then there's Monte Carlo.
Yeah. Okay. There's a whole bunch of Q learning.
We'll cover in a second deep Q learning. Q learning, this other split is, are you doing only a value function or doing a Q function?
There's a whole bunch of ways to learn Q functions. So yeah, there's a bunch of different Q learners. Yep.
What's the advantage of side-side versus Q learning?
Well, it sort of feels nice to be on policy. So it's sort of nice to learn the thing that you're trying to do. It was in fashion for a while. Everything that I know in the last 3 years has all been Q learning, not SARSA. So I haven't seen any Google DeepMind guy from SARSA recently.
But wouldn't I want to change my policy as soon as I update my Q so that the 3D thing then becomes my new policy?
Well, there are two ways. So do you want to update your policy as soon as you have a Q? As of like 3 years ago, the answer was no. People trained up a Go player and kept it fixed and then only used that for their policy and then trained up a new one. So it was a double queue, you with me? One queue, there's a convergence problem. If you're updating your queue function and your policy separately, it could get a little unstable. And so there are a lot of people, currently there's a big debate. Some people argue use one queue function when you actually learn and use an old frozen queue function for your policy, make it fast, make it approximate, and it'll be stable that way because you're learning how to beat your old self. That was dominant 3 years ago. AlphaZero says, oh no, use the same one for both of them. You can update it, just be careful about the stability. So you worry a little bit about stability if you're updating both yourself and the self you're playing for the future.
So SARSA is possibly more stable.
So SARSA is more stable, yep.
So when we have an on policy, we're given what the policy is?
Well, we're learning the policy. On the policy, what's the optimal policy? Arg max over A of Q of S and A. What's the policy here? Epsilon greedy. Arg max over A of Q of S and A, or probably epsilon, flip a coin. So that's the policy that SARSA would use. Q learning. I've stolen the wiki page here just to do a slight different variation. My new Q is equal to, they write 1 minus alpha, we've always written 1, times my old Q, plus a learning rate, times a reward you might get right now, which is often 0, but at the end of the game it's 1 or 0, plus a discount factor gamma, times something which is the best policy I can take, given the next state. What's missing implicit in this equation from Wiki? What does it not tell you how to compute? Yes, somehow I've got to pick S and T plus 1, right? I picked some action. You with me?
I picked some action with some policy. So
we're going to pick something like an epsilon greedy policy that will take us from S to S plus 1. Then we estimate how good the new S plus 1 will be. So note that there's two sort of pieces here. One is, in my current state, what action do I take? Maybe epsilon b. Once I'm in the new state, now I use some q function and pick optimal play under that new q function, that other q function, which might be the same as the other function. Right, so it makes sense? So this whole thing says, I'm in some state, I take some action, I take a gradient step alpha to move to make the new q value of my state and action more accurately approximating what it was with the old one, the delta. This is an approximation to what named equation? Bellman equation, right? Under convergence, this is equality, this is Bellman equation.
And there is a either stunningly strong or not that strong, depending on how you look at it,
fact about this. If the world is a Markov decision process, the real data come from Markov decision process, then
with a little bit of fine print. If you explore long enough and do enough randomized search, that's the fine print that you don't trust the mathematicians for. And then QLM will find an optimal policy, a truly globally optimal policy, right? This algorithm is guaranteed to find the best policy, or for a bunch of equally good ones, one of the best policies. It's a rare treat in machine learning to get something that guarantees global optimality. Why am I unimpressed? Yeah. If I search infinitely long, I can find the optimum. Okay, right, I'm impressed. Okay. Question?
You can anneal the learning rate, right?
And you can anneal the learning rate. And that people often do. You learn faster at first and learn slower later on. So it's common to adjust learning rates.
Good? The other piece we looked at, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
What's an episodic task? Is Go or chess an episodic task or not? Yes, ends at a finite time. If I'm controlling a call center, episodic or not? Not, I hope my call center keeps running for years, right? So episodic task just means it's something that has a finite episode and you actually get an A. Why does it matter? What piece of this do I often ignore for episodic tasks? The gamma. If I'm playing it, something that's just a game, I said gamma of 1. I don't actually care how long my Go or my chess game lasts, typically. I just want to win or lose. There's no discount factor typically used. Gamma of 1, typically in an episodic task, if it's a short episode. However, if I'm doing something like selling products to you, how long does Google want to be in business? Or Amazon? Desos? How long does he want to sell stuff for? Forever! But he still has a discount factor. He'd rather get a buck from you today than a buck from you next year. That's a discount factor, right? So for things like selling products, and these are increasingly used for things like product pricing, really starting and coming, that's an infinite game. So you gotta have a discount factor. You really don't care how many products you sell in 10 years, discounted. Cool, so this is one way to do stuff. It's a sort of a gradient descent-y sort of thing. We have a learning rate. We make Q closer to the correct Q. The other way to do it, which we covered, is deep Q learning, which says, let's go away and maybe our state or action, maybe they're one hot, but maybe they're real vectors. Who cares? Let's you learn a neural net for my Q function. Instead of a table lookup, learn a neural net function, but still a mapping from state and action. So, well, Q is a mapping of state and action to how much you expect your word to get. Right? So that's a real value mapping. And now I put some parameters data in there, my neural net weights. And I'd like to adjust my Q function, my neural net, so that it more closely approximates how good I think the current state is. How good is it? It's the current reward I got plus gamma times how good the next state is I ended up in under some policy. This is the same sort of thing I was doing before, but instead of doing a gradient descent in a table lookup where I've got a discrete set of actions, a discrete set of states, now I've got a function that maps state and action to value. But I can move toward minimizing this quadratic loss function by using gradient descent, or stochastic, or mini-batch gradient descent, or whatever. Yeah?
In the Monte Carlo method, isn't the point of that to estimate the Q values?
What gets replaced in the Monte Carlo method? Am I changing this Q here, or this thing over here? Where's the Monte Carlo? It's over here, right? What do? I could look up, if I'm TD0, I look up, I'm in this new state, I look up a Q function for it. If I'm in Monte Carlo, I'm in this new state, I play 500 games and estimate it.
Yeah, so wouldn't that fall under the category of Q1?
Yes.
Oh, because on one of your slides, you had Monte Carlo versus Q1.
Well, certainly it's Monte Carlo versus TD0. Is for sure a definitive. People, Q learning is often used in the more narrow, I'm being a little bit vague. It's used, sometimes Q learning is used in the very specific, where did it go?
Epsilon, greedy, then optimal Q learning. Although that one doesn't really say how I figure the Q function. Yeah, I would certainly call this all Q learning.
I'm scratching.
Yeah. And one of the quiz questions, it's
explore a number of possible game play paths, all of which terminate at the end of the game. So that sounds like the Monte Carlo method.
So the Monte Carlo version, in the current version of Monte Carlo, you play it all the way to the end, as opposed to a TD0, where you look one step ahead. So there's a big distinction. There's sort of two splits. There's a V versus Q, but all of the Q world. Now we have play it to the end, Monte Carlo, or look one step ahead, TD0.
Yeah, but that statement was false.
That
Q learning methods tend to explore a number of
because they don't have, Q learning doesn't have to be Monte Carlo, right? Lots of Q learning, if you look at this deep Q learning, look at my previous Q learning, where's the Monte Carlo in this? This is a perfectly fine TD0 method. Right? I can use this Bellman equation approximation, this Q learning thing, with TD0. This works beautifully for TD0. No Monte Carlo in this picture. Right?
Sort of like the default when you say Q learning is really TD0.
Yeah, I think so. I will try to avoid any questions like that in the exam. I don't like that level of specificity. I think
the issue of the word test.
What?
Across the issue of the word test. So Q learning tends to.
Yeah, it's not a good question, but the answer, but quite apart from it, lots of Q, in some sense, the historic Q learning, the original Q learning for sure was looking at a TD0 Q learning. You look at the historic Q learning label.
I will try not to ask technical detail questions like that. Okay, so deep Q learning has this advantage that you can now fit a neural net. And it has this same sort of piece. You're updating one Q function. There's another one which either you put the same Q function into and play it forward a bunch of times, or you plug in something else and play it a bunch of times, or you do TD0. That makes sense. These are all sort of Q-ish sort of things. But they all have this property that there is. You take one step by one policy, and then you play typically optimally going forward. Right? That's sort of an off-policy version of it. And you want to accept it being Sarsa.
Cool.
Okay, so picture. Here we got it. We have model-based stuff like dynamic programming. Solve the MVP. One step ahead, trying all possible successors. We have just exhaustive search. The way that you might play checkers. Try everything, don't learn at all. That's not reinforcement learning. We have model-free methods, either model-free methods where you take one possible action, go to a state of Monte Carlo, play it out, and estimate it, or model-free where you take one action and just look up how good it is, which is a TD0. Hopefully this chart now makes sense, sort of the summary of all reinforcement learning in one slide. Cool. Okay, I got time for one more thing, and I'm going to throw us out promptly at 5:30. Got to meet somebody at 4:30. Last question was auto scikit-learn. So the fancy term, which you don't need to remember, is combined algorithm selection hyperparameter optimization. But the idea of the auto scikit-learn, which is sort of cool, was for a whole bunch of data sets, for a whole bunch of hyperparameters, train up a bunch of models. You then have a bunch of data sets. Here's a hyperparameter vector, and here's how well the model performs in terms of accuracy. You can then learn a random forest, your favorite model, that says, for given hyperparameters, here's how good it should be. You got a forward model, make sense? Based on a crap load of training. Now you say, okay, great. Given a new set of hyperparameters, given a new model description, I have that right? Given these 38 meta features, what's N, what's P, how much data is missing, given these new meta features and hyperparameters, I can ask which hyperparameters for these meta features will give the best output, the lowest error. So I can do a search using my function that takes
problem description, like N and P and missing, and is it words or whatever, and hyperparameters, and search for hyperparameters to find the lowest error. I say those are probably good hyperparameters. I can start searching from there or use those. Then they ensemble, and they build a whole bunch. In this case, I think like 40 or 50. Wow, my optimum was a little bit tired there looking. They use an ensemble of 50 classifiers. And someone asked a good question, why not, once you got the 50 best classifiers, why not put those into a regression and then predict why, given the some weighted combination of my 50 predictions with a regression? Overfitting, right? So instead, what they do is they add them one by one, which is stage-wise, and they add them each with a unit weight. They don't estimate the weights on them, yeah?
So you think like the assumption behind this is that like those three metafeatures are not described, which hyperparameters you use in your data set, right?
The idea is the metaparameters, you're just having enough problem description that will tell you what hyperparameters are used on. And the later success on how super cool is actually look for word descriptions and put those features into.
Cool. I think we are basically out of time,
but you will all do wonderfully on the exam tomorrow, and I will see you there, and I will be alive and up on Piazza, but not past like 11 p.m. I think at night, I might be open to your See you all there with your pencils, and get some sleep yourself.